You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Stories of spiritual origins often begin as the new way emerges against the dominant traditions of the region. Thus, Siddhartha grows up among the Brahmins and Moses among the Egyptians. Joseph Smith and Elijah Muhammad, each in his own way, emerges among American Protestants. But what about the much older Arabian Muhammad? Many stories of Islam's rise situate Muhammad among the polytheists, proclaiming one God to folks with plentiful spirits. That's certainly the way that I learned the story. But Gabriel Saeed Reynolds invites us in his recent book, Christianity and the Quran, from Yale University Press, to consider another possibility. What if Arabian Christianity stands as the Quran's earliest conversation counterpart and its most important? Christian Humanist Profiles stands glad to welcome Dr. Reynolds on the show to talk about his research on these questions. Gabriel, thank you for joining us.
Very happy to be here. Thanks, Nathan.
I want you to start by telling our listeners about Rawaka, and pardon my pronunciation on that one, a Christian living in Arabia who meets a stranger and speaks some particular words to him. Whom has he met and what does he say? And who tells this story of Rawaka?
Yeah, terrific place to start, Nathan, because in a way, this is the beginning of the story of Muhammad in the Islamic classical sources, which give the biography of his life. So he has his first 40 years, and then his call to prophethood takes place when he's meditating, by the traditional account, on a mountain outside of Mecca. And different stories describe sort of his experience of meditation and an angelic visitation in different ways. But one of the sort of high points of the story that they tell is when he comes down from that mountain, he goes to his wife, his only wife at the time. Her name is Khadija. And the stories tell the scene in which Muhammad is in a sort of state of kind of awe, nervousness, anxiety. And Khadija sort of affirms him and affirms the experience that he's just had as something valid and authentic. But then she also does something else, which is she calls on her cousin, Waraqa ibn Nawfal, according to the traditional account. And he comes over, and the reader at this point sort of suspects that he must have some particular expertise or maybe spiritual wisdom to assess a kind of spiritual experience that Muhammad has gone through. And most of these narrations add that either explicitly he was a Christian or that he used to read or write the gospel. And maybe later we'll speak about the Arabic word for gospel. And so one suspects that A, he was a Christian, and B, he had a Bible, if that's what the word here alludes to when it says he had a book or he had the gospel. And he comes to affirm, as Khadija, his cousin, did, the authenticity of Muhammad's experience and affirm that he is a prophet whom God has sent to his people.
Now, one of your early claims is that the Quran does not mechanically cite biblical and other Christian texts, but does creative things with those traditions. Now, when I've taught Quranic texts in medieval literature classes, that take on the Quran's Joseph Surah and the Mary narrative seemed pretty obvious to me, but that's not always the way that scholarship on the history of Islam starts. What right. kinds of stories have historians of Islam told about Christianity's relationships with Quranic composition, and what makes creativity a more promising framework for thinking about these relationships?
Right. Terrific question. In a way, it sort of follows naturally from the first sort of biographical bit about Waraqa and Muhammad on a mountain. In fact, most Western scholars, so especially non-Muslim Western scholars working in universities and fancy places like that, they put a great deal of trust in the traditional stories that involve people like Waraqa. So that's sort of their starting point in thinking through the question of the biblical material of the Quran, since their assumption is, more or less, Muhammad is the author of the Quran. So when they seek to assess why is there this or that sort of biblical language or biblical turn of phrase in the Quran, they ask themselves, well, who could Muhammad have met? And, you know, what were his possible sources? The, sort of the the most foundational work on the Bible and the Quran was written in the early 19th century by a German scholar, and it's entitled simply, What Did Muhammad Borrow from Judaism? So that's sort of like the framework or the lens in which scholars in the academy address this question. So take the example of Warqa, for example. You know, scholars would say, okay, we have this story. Warqa is a real person. You know, maybe the story is sort of, I don't know, exaggerated or has some flourishes, but he's a real person. And so we should sort out what kind of Christian he was. Did he belong to some heresy? And then what sort of scripture did he have? Was it the canonical New Testament, you know, the 27 books of the New Testament as we know it now? Was it maybe some other apocryphal scripture? So that's kind of the standard approach, which is to begin with the prophet's biography. And then, you know, through that biography, think about why the Quran is presenting biblical materials in a particular way. And, you know, the sort of upshot or the implication of that approach is that when the Quran differs from the Bible or other Jewish or Christian writings, it's because of Muhammad's source. So in a way, this approach sort of takes all agency away from the author of the Quran. Any sort of deviation from the Bible is due to the particular kind of Christian or the particular kind of apocryphal gospel that Muhammad had access to. And he just sort of mechanically repeated his sources, which were deficient. I don't know if that makes sense. Feel free to follow up.
That makes a good deal of sense. Yeah, so the reason I ask that question the way I do is because the stereotype, to be sure, and to some extent the reality of German biblical scholarship is that they are fixated on the redaction moments and the creative moments of the biblical composition, so that you have, you know, multiple sources, each with its own creative agenda, if you will, in your mind. And, you know, again, I don't expect for you to have the authoritative word, but I'm curious what your speculation is. Why did German scholarship on the Quran and the Bible differ so much on this kind of approach?
Yeah. Terrific. I was worried for a moment that you might say that the Germans did the same thing, or the German speakers did the same thing with Quranic studies. And actually, you're 100% right. They did not. They took a different approach, which was to sort of affirm the single authorship of the Quran with essentially no redaction and no real concern for questions of this sort of social or cultural context in which the authors were working, in which might have affected the way that the author articulated things in the Quran. So those kinds of questions that we find in, say, form criticism or redaction criticism in biblical studies, they're just not there. So instead, you have this really surprising reliance on traditional stories about Muhammad, which are written quite late. I know they come from the 8th century, not the 7th century. And then kind of working with those stories to sort things out about Muhammad. And actually, Nathan, it's even more dramatic than this, because oftentimes it's not only German speakers who did this in the 19th, early 20th century. Also, basically all of the so-called Orientalists, you know, so the English and the French and others as well, they often would ask questions about Muhammad's psychology. And I mean, I say a word or two about this. I don't want to go off on too many tangents. But so there was this assumption that, okay, you have like these traditions which tell us something about who was there, which Christians or Jews were there. But then they try to enter into sort of the thought world of Muhammad and say, oh, he was based usually on a turn of phrase in the Quran here or there or some report. And they would say, oh, he was nervous about this or that. He was worried about this. He had a tendency to maybe overthink, that sort of thing. So they really psychologize things in a way that, I mean, it's sort of shocking when you compare it to the work that's done already by people like Wellhausen and others when it comes to the Bible in the late 19th century.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine Julius Wellhausen asking, you know, what was on Moses' mind.
Exactly.
Now, my own background in Christian history doesn't say much about Christianity in Arabia before Islam, so your book's opening chapter was fascinating to me. Talk to our listeners for a moment about the linguistic scene on the peninsula. Do we know why Christians mainly wrote in Syriac rather than Arabic, or just that they wrote in Syriac rather than Arabic?
Yeah, great, great. Thanks for that question. So maybe just a step back first to say, I mean, it's kind of implied in my first couple of responses to your questions, but to step back just to say that, you know, my approach is dramatically different from the sort of standard Western approach to the Quran. I don't assume that Muhammad is the author of the Quran, although, you know, this book and basically my scholarship is historical critical. So I'm not a Muslim. I'm not asking theological questions as a believer about the text, even though I find that very interesting, actually. But we set that aside for now. Just the historical critical approach that I take is not to assume that Muhammad is the author. And so that once you take that step and you have to defend it, especially kind of in the guild of Quranic studies. So you have to defend it. And mine is a minority position. So, but if we skip the defense and the arguments I would make in that regard, once you take that step, suddenly everything looks a lot different, right? So in a way, it means sort of zooming back with your lens. And instead of focusing on sort of particular traditions about Muhammad in the city of Mecca or Muhammad in the city of Medina, suddenly you become interested in kind of the larger scene of the Middle East at the time. So the traditional dates of Muhammad's life are AD 570 to AD 632. And, you know, traditional location is Mecca, Medina. But if we just sort of zoom back, we can then really think about kind of the Middle East, the Arabian Peninsula in particular, during this time. So late 6th, early 7th centuries. And just as you note, Nathan, so this is a time where the Christian world is flourishing in terms of its literary production and its religious thought. And that articulation in the Middle East is taking place principally in Greek and Syriac. So those are the two big languages. You know, there are more. You know, you have Coptic, of course, in Egypt, but we'll just stick with Greek in Syriac. And so, I mean, it gets a little bit complicated. I don't want to get lost in the weeds here. But in the region, basically from, say, Damascus, really further north, Antioch, Aleppo, down to the Arabian Peninsula, these two languages are coexisting in terms of literary languages. So, you know, very often in the same area, you have people writing in Syriac, which is a Semitic language like Hebrew, and people writing in Greek. Of course, Greek is everywhere in this region, thanks to Alexander the Great. But then you have this third language, which is widely spoken, but has almost left us almost no written records at all, which is Arabic. So effectively, Nathan, the Quran is our first Arabic book. Before the Quran, we really only have rock inscriptions. So, you know, a couple of lines here and there. There are traditions of Arabic, pre-Islamic Arabic poetry, but we don't have a single manuscript of pre-Islamic poetry that can be dated to the pre-Islamic period. So, you know, people try to, you know, make a case that this or that line is really authentic and pre-Islamic. But in terms of any documentary evidence, it simply was Arabic was not a literary language before the rise of Islam.
So it's very different from the New Testament in that respect, where you have a very rich literary culture into which the letters of Paul and the written gospels emerge. So, I mean, the Quran really does stand as the genesis of not only the worship traditions that we call Islam, but also of Arabic literature, as far as we can tell.
100%. 100%. Yeah. It's really fascinating to bring those two things into conversation, because the sort of linguistic context for, you know, the late first century composition in the New Testament books, where Greek within Judaism, you know, not only among the pagans, but as you know better than I do, within Judaism, you know, had a long tradition already. You know, the Septuagint had already been sort of a fundamental text for Jewish thought. That it's completely unlike the situation for the rise of Islam. Now, one sort of footnote to that, however, is that there's a decent reason to think that Christian missionaries, even if the written records we have of them working in the Middle East are in Syriac, there are a couple of reasons to think that they had begun to carry out missions in Arabic. And it's also
written
possible,
as well as spoken.
Written
Arabic as well as spoken.
So definitely spoken, 100%. So we have anecdotes of recorded in Greek or Syriac of this or that monk, for example, going off among this or that tribe of the Arabs and preaching the gospel to them, baptizing this or that many people. But there's also reason to think that there was some writing, and that gets a little technical, but it has to do with the origin of the Arabic script. So that modern, which is not modern at all because it dates from the 7th century, but so the 7th century Arabic script really is a new thing. It appears on the scene, most likely, you know, it develops in the 6th century out of a form of Aramaic, and then, you know, was fully put to use in the Quran in terms of literary production for the first time. But it definitely was not the creation of the author of the Quran, because those rock inscriptions that I mentioned from the 6th century already use the Arabic script. And the majority of those rock inscriptions are Christian. So it's possible that the Christian missionaries had in fact developed the Arabic script for the sake of the missions. I don't know if that was clear.
Very good.
Like
very good.
A little bit lost.
And
hopefully
that's interesting, because that's analogous to the story of Christian mission in England, where you have a runic script that predates Christian mission. But as far as alphabetic English, it seems to be a monastic invention.
Okay.
Not to say that no
and
one spoke English beforehand.
As well, which I don't know super well, but you know, famously the Slavic or the Cyrillic script for Slavic languages. And there are other analogies, maybe with the Georgian, Armenian, and some other scripts in the East. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I want to turn to two concepts that I found especially interesting. One of them is the concept that in the Quran, Jesus is mainly an argument maker character rather than a healer or a community builder or, you know, one of the other roles that the New Testament and other Christian texts might focus on. And the other one is that when the Quran does engage with biblical texts, the phrase that you use is turn of phrase. So, I mean, you know, why is that idea of a turn of phrase important for the way that we think about, you know, Quranic engagements with the Bible? And how does that play out in the Quran's version of Jesus?
Great, great. Thank you. Thank you for the question. So two really important points, which are related, but maybe best treated separately. So the first one on Jesus as argument maker. I mean, the place to start, I think, is just to sort of double down on the point that the Jesus of the Quran is a very, very different character from the Jesus of the Gospels in the New Testament. And I don't mean just in terms of theology. So, you know, you often hear, you know, for Muslims, Jesus is just a prophet. He's not the Son of God, et cetera, et cetera. Or, you know, people might focus on the crucifixion. So the Quran has Jesus apparently not crucified, whereas, you know, for Christians, he's a crucified savior who offers himself as a sacrifice. So even if we set those things aside and just look at sort of the literary data, there is essentially nothing that Jesus says in the Gospels that appears in the Quran. And the very few things that Jesus says in the Quran are obviously necessarily new, original. There's no quotations of the New Testament. So what is the newness or the originality of the Jesus of the Quran? It's essentially, as you said, Nathan, the use of the Quran's author of Jesus to make arguments. So I'll just give one example. There's a passage, one of the few passages which focuses on Jesus, and there's really not that many of them, but in Quran, Chapter 3, Quran is 114 chapters. Chapters at the beginning of the book are longer. Chapter 3 is one of the longer ones. So around verse 52, I think, the Quran has Jesus sort of, so the listener is sort of privileged to have this sort of ability to listen in to what Jesus says to his followers. And he says, who will be my supporter for God or with God? And it's really curious, right? So what's going on here? Why is Jesus calling out for a supporter or supporters? And then a group of people whom the Quran calls the apostles. That's actually a little bit complicated too, but they say, we will support you with God. And then we shift in the narration in chapter 3, and a sort of omniscient narrator says in the third person, So God supported his followers, Jesus's followers. And then there's a quotation from God himself in which God says to Jesus, again, the audience is sort of listening in. So it's interesting to think how the narration is sort of constructed by the author. And God says, Jesus, I will take you and raise you up and purify you of your opponents and raise you above the unbelievers until the day of resurrection. It was all very vague and ambiguous. I mean, there's no names other than Jesus. There's no geographical, chronological place names. I mean, there's just nothing, no kind of details. But the general vibe is Jesus was a character who was faced with enemies. God had his back, and God supported Jesus and his followers above their enemies. I'll finish up here in a second. Oh, no, I'm going on too long, Nathan. For me, this account is a really interesting manifestation of the use to which the Quranic author puts Jesus, because essentially this is the context of Muhammad and Muhammad's followers. So Jesus becomes a sort of proto-Muhammad. The basic argument of the Quran about Muhammad is that Muhammad is God's prophet. Those who sort of join their cause with Muhammad will have God as their ally, and consequently, they will be victorious against their enemies. So, you know, everyone should accept Muhammad's prophethood, join the new movement, join the new believers. Do not be afraid. God will have your back. Your enemies will be vanquished, just as God had Jesus's back and vanquished his enemies.
That's where the turn of phrase occurred to me, because all of those things that you just said, along with the fact that his enemies are unnamed, are very reminiscent of the biblical Psalms, right? The frequent mention of enemies without mentioning who these enemies are, promises that God will protect the psalmist against the enemies. All of this, you know, sounds very psalmic, again, but as you say, without any geographic reference, without any concrete historical reference. So is that huge... what you had in mind with the turn of phrase?
It was not when I was writing it, but I think you're right. And actually, you know, in the last couple of months, I taught a course here at Notre Dame in the fall on God and the Quran. And through the back and forth with the students, I've been thinking more and more about the Psalms in particular. And I know it's a bit of a deviation, but Nathan, I think it's a really important point. So I mentioned the Quran has 114, I forget if I said the word chapters, but they're not really chapters. So, you know, chapter one, the Arabic word is surah. So surah one does not lead into surah two, which does not lead into surah three. They're really independent units. And so I often say chapter just because it's convenient, but they're really not chapters. If what we understand by chapters is, I don't know, if you're reading Tale of Two Cities or something, and, you know, this story progresses through the French Revolution, it's not that. You have these units which clearly are meant to be recited. The author is clearly concerned about the stylistic dimension of the text he's producing, and they're also meant to be prayed with. Clearly, they have a sort of hymnic, maybe that's the wrong term because it's over-Christianizing maybe, but a sort of hymnic quality to them. So yeah, I think the question of the Psalms is very important to thinking about the Quran.
Very good, very good.
And one more thing, Nathan, just on the Psalms. Sorry, I'll be super quick. But it's important to keep in mind in thinking through that for Christians and presumably Jews, but I know much less about the lived Judaism of late antiquity, but for Christians in late antiquity, the Psalms were not just, I don't know, something written by David that are just, you know, an interesting bit of history and happened to be in the Bible. But this was the scripture with which Christians prayed, especially in sort of ecclesiastical monastic circles. And, you know, if you asked a Christian from the 5th or 6th century, you know, where did the Psalms come from? You know, they would see it as a divine book, as God's word, the words which God has given us to worship him. Anyway, I'll leave it at that.
No. That's a very valid point. And when the Quran does interact with the Bible, you point to an allusive style of engagement. So my question there historically is, in what ways is that mode of engagement, that allusive style, typical for Christian and Jewish and other encounters with biblical texts in this period? And in what ways is the Quran doing something very different from other writings of the historical moment?
Yeah, great question. I think it's very different. It's the Quran is exceptional, principally because, well, only because it is written as a scripture. And there's really nothing like that. So, you know, something that sort of approaches that in the Syriac tradition, you have these homilies, which are written not really as homilies, but as sort of works of praise and adoration. So, you know, Ephraim, Jacob of Sarug, some of these authors that, you know, your listeners may or may not know, but, you know, there's something there of that, but they're written by Jacob as a sort of lesson for the congregation. The Quran is unique because of the claim it's making that there's a new prophet, which is scandalous to Judaism and Christianity in the 7th century. And, you know, that's directly connected to its absolutely unique engagement with the Bible and its rhetorical stylistic qualities.
Very good. So, I mean, one of the things that, you know, distinguishes then, if I understand you right, is that the Jewish and Christian writings of the period understand themselves pretty in a pretty self-aware way as commentary rather than as prophecy.
I think it's a very good way to put it. Now, you may know, Nathan, that the Syriac homilists, most famously Ephraim and Jacob of Sarug, they almost always open their homilies with an appeal to the Holy Spirit to speak through them. So there is a sort of prophetic element to at least the literary form of these homilies. Are they actually transcripts of a homily that was given in a church? I think they were not. Philip Fornes, I think, is a scholar who's worked on that question. You know, so you would have had an initial homily delivered orally, and then the homilies given to us in the manuscripts, you know, are sort of a second stage where they were worked over. But in any case, yeah, I mean, what we have with the Quran is, you know, dramatically different.
Very good. I want to turn to some specifically Arabic linguistic questions. Mm-hmm. One of them is that when the Quran, pardon me, refers to the gospel, mm-hmm. It tends to imply that it's referring to a singular book rather than four gospel narratives or to, mm-hmm. you know, a collection of New Testament books. And then the other thing is that, you know, when you tell readers about the pre-Islamic Arabic inscriptions that you mentioned earlier, they tend to refer to God's Messiah rather than God's Son when they refer to Jesus. So all three of these, I think, raise some very interesting historical questions. What kinds of questions do they bring up in your mind, and how would you begin to answer those questions?
Yeah, terrific. So on the last point about God's Messiah, I'll start with that and then turn to gospel, and then maybe you can follow up with the third point after that, so I don't go on too long. So in fact, we do have a couple of inscriptions from the south of the Arabian Peninsula. So in what's called ancient South Arabian, which is actually not Arabic, very close to Arabic, which referred to Jesus as God's Messiah. However, further to the north in the Arabian Peninsula,
And just real quick, for me and for our listeners, Mecca and Medina, where are they on that north-south?
Yeah, they're in the north. So they're in the sort of standard Arabic-speaking zone. So the modern country of Yemen and the southern sort of, I don't know, the strip of Saudi Arabia. It's basically their mountains down there, which lead to a natural cultural division. Yeah, so down there in the south, we do have that phrase. People have made a lot of about that, and, you know, they've argued that phrase referring to Jesus as God's Messiah signals a Christianity that had a low Christology, which maybe formed a sort of starting point for the Quran's own low Christology. I think that's saying more than we have evidence for. We just have a couple of inscriptions. And, you know, Christians say all sorts of things. And they don't always have like a system, a theological system behind that. In the northern inscriptions, we have, you know, simple references to God and to to a formal Christian, like Christian language and prayers, to crosses. I can't think of a reference to Jesus as God's son, but I can't think of any, unusual heterodox reference to the Trinity in any of those inscriptions. They're very short. It's like, Jesus, save me. Those kinds of inscriptions. It's just very, very, with a cross. That's the kind of stuff you get. The more important point is that we know from the literary record, again, in Syriac and Greek, that we know basically the churches that were there. It was above all the Miaphysite church. We don't have any evidence of particular heresies. So I think that there's not much there in the argument about this being important because of a low Christology. Should I go ahead and say the gospel thing?
Go ahead and do the gospel thing.
All right. Okay. So, another really interesting point is, just as you said, Nathan, the Quran never uses the plural gospels with an S. It only uses this Arabic word, Injil, El Injil, which is the singular, so the gospel. And we translate that as gospel because pretty clearly Injil derives from the Greek word euangelion, which, you know, it's more complicated how you get to the English word gospel. It's actually easier or a straighter path to get from the Greek to the Arabic. But, you know, they both ultimately come from the same place. So the word does mean gospel. It has it in the singular. But again, this is a case, as with Jesus, where the use of this word, it's just not the use of the word gospel that circulated among Christians at the time. You know, for Christians, the gospel is, you know, either the New Testament, sometimes the whole Bible, or the proclamation of Jesus, you know, as the Savior, as the Son of divine Son of God. The Quran does not use the gospel in this way. It uses it as the book which was like the Quran now being given to Muhammad.
Very good. Now, I want to turn to worship practices, because when the Quran describes prayer, some of the concrete practices seem to reflect Christian monastic practices. So what are those practices, and what does this relationship illuminate when it comes to the worship life of folks on the Arabian Peninsula in Muhammad's day, whether we're talking about those Christian missionaries or whether we're talking about early Muslims? What does worship look like, and to what extent does the Quran invent that, and to what extent does the Quran reflect that?
Terrific. Yeah, great, great question. It's a little bit hard to answer with full confidence, but if we just begin maybe with some of the data. So the Quran refers to Christian priests. Look at Quran 582, for example. It refers to Christian monks. So that's also in 582, also in 931, some other verses as well. And then there are some passages which are very positive, which seem to hold up monks. They're sort of used as an example for Muhammad's own community or the early Muslim community. You know, you should be like these guys. Look at the monks, basically. You know, the most interesting place for me where that is shown is in Quran chapter 24, starting with verse 35. That's a very famous verse called the light verse. But if you read the following verses, basically 36 to 38, you see that the light verse is actually intimately connected to the example of Christian monks praying in their monasteries, or maybe their sort of hermit cells, and dedicating themselves entirely to God, sacrificing other things. So you do have this language. By the way, the Quran in another place refers to monasteries, probably. The word is a little complicated. And also to something that might be churches. Well, there's actually one word that's clearly churches, and there's another word which is often translated as oratories. It's a bit more vague. In any case, it's just important to underline those things, because the Quran is not simply in an antagonistic position to Christian teaching. It is definitely in competition, in my opinion, with Christianity. But then in its effort to send a message to its own audience, it does have a tendency to hold up Christians in a positive way. You know, look at these guys, probably mostly monks, who give everything, their whole lives to God. You know, take heed lest, you know, you don't sort of live up to the standards that they've set.
So is it oversimplifying, or does it capture something to say that in general, the Quran respects the practice of Christians, but it opposes the dogma of Christians.
I think that's probably, probably a great way to summarize it. There are a couple of places where there's some criticism of Christian leaders. It's very hard, though, to say with confidence whether the Quran is speaking about sort of the same issue in two different places. All we have are these 114 chapters of the Quran, and who knows why there's a different take on Christians. In my opinion, however, what you say is overwhelmingly the case. Christian dogma is bad. Christians themselves are good.
Very good. Very good. Well, I think we've given our listeners enough historical data at this point to get to what I take to be your book's programmatic statement in chapter 4. And I'll quote it verbatim, quote, "Christianity is the Quran's ever-present, although sometimes invisible, conversation partner," end quote. So what kinds of questions, whether about the ways that worship traditions relate to each other generally, or about the history of Christianity and Islam in particular, what kinds of questions does this research program open up that might have been closed with the more traditional, I mean, oversimplifying it, that the German questions might miss?
Great. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that. So, this is sort of one of the most exciting parts of the research and the book. I mean, maybe I'm the only one that would describe the book as exciting, but nevertheless, to me. So it's great that you introduce this by saying engagement with Christianity and not just the New Testament. So there's things to be said about, strictly speaking, biblical material in the Quran, but also we have a robust engagement with Christian legends, Christian stories. So this might be surprising to listeners. You know, the greatest examples are in Quran chapter 18. So I'll just mention two of the stories there. There's actually four stories at least in that chapter. But the two longest and maybe most interesting ones include a story about young men who fall asleep in a cave for 309 years. And then God wakes them up, and the people who find them after they've, woken up, learn a lesson about God's ability to raise the dead, basically the resurrection of the body. So this story was extremely well known among Christians. It's known in Christian tradition as the Seven Sleepers of Ephesus. It's probably a story which was meant to sort of make a statement in the context of debates around the resurrection of the body, which really were taking place. I don't want to go into it, too far, but it just shows that the Quran is engaging with a Christian issue there. And at one point, the Quran even says there, do not ask them, just says them, how long the sleepers were sleeping. So to me, there's no doubt that the them are Christians. And so that's really interesting because it gives us a sign that Christians are not just in distant places like Damascus or Jerusalem or somewhere. Christians are right there. There's a real danger that the audience of the Quran will go and ask Christians, maybe a Christian neighbor, about the story about the seven men who went to sleep. And then the other one I'll just mention very briefly, we can follow up if you want about it, which is at the end of chapter 18, you have a story of a figure who is simply known as the one with two horns. And this figure goes to the ends of the earth. Achieves this almost miraculous deed of walling off some place and keeping the evil people of Gog and Magog behind the wall, which somehow preserves the earth. And this figure is clearly from Christian tradition, Alexander the Great. He's only called the two-horned one in the Quran, so people online fight about this. Many Muslims don't like the idea that it would be Alexander, since he's a good guy in the Quran, and Alexander was a pagan. Nevertheless, Christians were telling all kinds of stories about Alexander the Great. They effectively had baptized him in late antiquity. And so, those examples just show us that the Quran is sort of engaging with the Christian world of late antiquity that wasn't just far off in the distance, but was right there among its audience.
Very good. I do have to follow up on the seven sleepers because I have never encountered this story, and I I had intentions at one point of reading it before we recorded, but I didn't get around to it. In the Christian versions of it or in the Quranic versions of it, is there ever any sort of Rip Van Winkle element to it, to where the seven sleepers are aware of changes in the world, or do they wake up pretty much to the world that they fell asleep in?
Yeah, it's totally different. I wish I knew the story of Rip Van Winkle better, but I think
okay,
it's
okay. So
totally...
Rip Van Winkle, real quick, he falls asleep in the Catskills Mountain as a loyal subject of King George. And when he wakes up, the American Revolution has happened, and he can't understand why people get so angry when he says, "Long live the king."
Yeah. So 100%. Yeah. I mean, probably. Yeah. So Rip Van Winkle might be indirectly even sort of, a development on later versions of the Seven Sleepers story. So the Christian story, which has clear echoes in the Quran, is that there are faithful Christians. They live in the city of Ephesus. Ephesus has a particular cult to either Apollo or Artemis. I forget which pagan god.
Artemis.
100%. Thank you. The emperor at the time is the evil Christ-hating emperor Decius. So mid-second century, according to the story. It's written centuries later. But this is a context in which it's set.
As is Rip Van Winkle.
Decius is coming to... Decius is coming to town. And he's going to compel all of the Christians to offer sacrifices to the gods, including Artemis. These young men are having none of it, so they flee off into a cave where they're protected. They wake up during the reign of Theodosius II. So this is now 5th century. He's a Christ-loving emperor. And they're hungry when they wake up, which makes sense. It's been a long time. And so they send one of their members into the city, and he shows up and he sees all these churches, buildings with crosses, and he's like, "What has gone on here?" And the story goes on from there. It's a terrific story, but yes, that dimension is a big part of sort of the charm and beauty of the Seven Sleepers of Ephesus.
And so, my American literature scholars out there in the audience, when you write this article up, be sure that Dr. Reynolds is a footnote, and remember me well when you write this article up, because
Nathan, I have to say there is a really great article written by a British scholar named. It'll come to me in a second, Robert Hoyland, which is about another episode in the Quran, chapter 2. I think it's verse 258. It's just one verse where there's a similar thing that goes on. Someone falls asleep, wakes up, and he entitles the article something like "The Man and His Donkey and Rip Van Winkle." So it's in the title of his article. So he's the guy who should get a footnote.
Wonderful, wonderful. I want to turn to the Mary narrative in the Quran, because this is one that I've taught many times in those medieval literature classes that I mentioned earlier. And the connection that always occurred to me, not having really any background in Quranic studies, is between Mary's narrative and Elijah at the oasis in the biblical book of Kings. Mm-hmm. Elijah is fleeing from royal killers. He is sustained at the oasis by a miraculous act of God. As a result, offers praise. And that just occurred to me as a natural parallel with what's going on there with Mary's narrative, where she goes into the wilderness, she is sustained, Jesus, when he is, when he encounters those who doubt her virgin birth, offers that sermon. So certainly differences, but also certainly parallels. So here's my connection. You make a different connection than I did, linking the Mary Surah to late antique Christian texts. So what are those texts, and how pervasive is this miraculous provision from God in the wilderness places motif in this region's story of holy people in this historical period?
Yeah, I really like how you put that question, because there's more than one thing that's going on in the famous story of Mary and Jesus in chapter 19 of the Quran, which is named Mary, Maryam in Arabic. It's important to keep in mind in thinking through this episode and every other episode in the Quran that, in my opinion, the Quranic author it's not really enough to just say creative. Yes, creative, but has a number of concerns as he's composing. So one of those is simply stylistic. The Quran rhymes. So it's just completely different than someone sitting down and write a story in Greek, a prose story in Greek or Latin or whatever. you know, he's much more constricted by this stylistic principle that things are going to rhyme for the sake of producing a liturgical text. So, and then there's particular theological or dogmatic ideas which the author has, which also, you know, shape the story in a significant way. So, maybe a starting point for me, though, in thinking about its relationship to earlier stories is the story of the flight of the Holy Family, which we have, I think, in Matthew. I think it's Matthew.
Yep, Matthew's Gospel. Yep.
Okay. And, according to which, the Holy Family fled from the threats of Herod and they went to Egypt. You know, Joseph receives different angelic visitations. The Quranic story is significantly different. As you said, Joseph is nowhere to be found. Mary gives birth to Jesus in a remote place. So it's not the Lucan narrative of Jesus' birth in Bethlehem, we're visited by shepherds and things. She's all alone. So much could be said about this. You're right, the baby Jesus, it seems to be the infant Jesus, gives a little sermon there, but it's very hard to know. Islamic tradition says it's right after the birth, and this is the miraculous speech of an infant. The Quran does say that Jesus spoke in the cradle, so I guess that's a good reason to go that route, but the Quran 19 itself doesn't explicitly say this. There's actually a dispute over one passage, whether it's Gabriel speaking or Jesus speaking. So there's a lot going on there, but you're right. The little speech of Jesus where he defends Mary is really important to the narrative. And in that little sermon, Jesus calls himself a servant of God. He also speaks of himself as defending the honor of Mary. He also speaks about receiving the book. It's really a sort of catechesis there on the Islamic presentation of Jesus. Jesus is used as a sort of, what better spokesman would there be for the Christology of the new movement than Jesus himself? You know, he's their spokesman there to basically say, this is the truth about Jesus, that he's just a servant of God. And there's this dimension with Mary where probably there's some concern with calumnies attributed to Jews about Mary. So, Mary's people accuse her of fornication, essentially, implicitly, and Mary seems to defend, Jesus seems to defend his mother against that charge in particular.
And I'm curious, because I'm a lot more familiar with Western European and British Mary devotion in this period. Is there a strong Mary devotion tradition in this region that, this would have been interacting with? Or again, is this something that, is invented in the Quran and then, happens to resonate with what's going on in different parts of the world?
Yeah, great. So absolutely. Mary is a central figure in the life of Eastern Christians. As you may know, at the Council of Ephesus in the first part of the 5th century, and then again at Chalcedon in 451, she is proclaimed Mother of God, Theotokos. This is something which the Church of the East will not accept. But in any case, this is a really central aspect of the spirituality of Christians, that God has chosen Mary. She is the pure vessel that he has chosen, to enter into the human story. And Mary not only is sort of dignified by that choice, but in her own sort of heroic spirituality and purity sets an example for all believers, men and women. So, yeah, it's a huge deal. We know this from iconography, of course, in the East as well. I think that's a really, really important point, is the place of Mary. The Quran in chapter 66 actually holds up Mary as well as an example for its own, the women, specifically the women in its own community. And I think that this whole episode says something about the way the Quran engages with Christians. So there's a lot more hostility towards Jews in the Quran, and there's a sort of wooing of Christians. The Quran, for example, has an episode in which Christians are said to be the closest in friendship to Muslims. It has Christians weep when they hear the Quran and proclaim that they believe in it. You know, we started with the story of Waraqa, which is from probably a different time period, but that's kind of emerging from this picture of Christians in the Quran. And so, you know, to me, there's a, you know, great young scholar named Murad Takawi, who just published a book called The Quran as Classic, where he really explores this idea. The Quranic engagement with Christians probably reflects the overwhelming demographic presence of Christians in its context, whereas Jews were a very small community. And so, you know, you could sort of use the Jews as a nemesis of both communities, because your principal concern was winning over Christians to the new community.
That makes good sense. After you discuss the Mary narratives, you note that almost all of the biblical narratives that the Quran retells are miracles of Jesus. To the neglect of the great signs of Moses or Elijah or the apostles of Jesus or other biblical figures. So my question is, rhetorically or symbolically or on whatever register you prefer to think about it, what questions arise from this concentration of miracle episodes on Jesus in particular to the exclusion of these other biblical figures?
Yeah, terrific. Yeah, the Quran is unusually interested in Jesus's miracles. I think this is principally because Christians were citing Jesus's miracles as arguments for his divinity. And so, you know, the Quranic author has a choice at this point, you know, to deny the miracles entirely or to accept them and deny the claim that they redound to Jesus' divinity. So it goes for the second option. And, you know, the number of miracles that the Quran lists for Jesus is really impressive already. I mean, there's a lot of miracles in the gospel accounts, of course, but, you know, lots of miracles for Moses as well. You know, some of those are mentioned in the Quran, but there's so little information on Jesus in the Quran, and that information is above all the miracles. So that sort of proportion of focus within the Jesus material on miracles tells us that there's something going on. And so just to name a couple of the miracles. So Quran 5:110 and then 3:49 maybe. Someone will correct me maybe in the comments. But you have this list of miracles. You know, he created a bird from clay, breathed into it, and brought it to life. He raised the dead. He healed the blind. He healed the lepers. He had these clairvoyance miracles in which he knew what people were eating. So we have all these miracles. Now, for most of those miracles, the Quran adds, he did this by the permission of God. So that the Quran is so interested in adding that little statement, bi'iznillah is what the Arabic is. It's just a little, that it almost always adds that for Jesus' miracles, tells us that there's, in my opinion, that Christians were citing these miracles and saying, listen, God created Adam from clay, breathed into him, and brought Adam to life. Jesus created a bird out of clay, breathed into the bird, and brought it to life. The divine power is present in Jesus's breath. Right? It's a very sort of profound, impressive argument. And, you know, the Quran seeks to just defang that argument by saying, bi'iznillah. So God, you know, just used Jesus as an instrument.
So I realize now that my pronunciation of that phrase has been entirely too influenced by Queen, but is that the same bismillah as one recognizes?
Oh, no, I think, I don't know the Queen song, but that sounds like it's the
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, so the opening of Quranic surahs is Bismillah Rahman Rahim.
And yes, that is the phrase, because I've seen that referred to.
Yeah, but Freddie Mercury, you may know, Nathan, I believe was a Zoroastrian. But
yes,
anyway,
yes,
he was South Asian. You know, was his family, I think, was in East Africa, South Asian, and there would have been a lot of Muslims in that community around him. So that could be it.
Very good. Very like I said, the only thing that triggered that question was I heard you pronounce it properly, and I realized, why do I think it's pronounced this other way? And I thought, no, it's because of Queen, and that's,
I mean,
a little embarrassing.
So interesting, but that's for another episode, I guess. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Well, Gabriel, one of the book's last discussions has to do with parables as a genre attributed to great holy figures. And this discussion was fascinating to me because I'm always interested in narrative form. What does the Quran inherit and what does the Quran invent when it comes to parables? Is this idea that, you know, holy people have a special ability to speak parables something that is already in the region? And how long is it there? Or is it something that, you know, is new with the Quran?
Yes. So I think this is a direct engagement with Christian tradition. The Old Testament Hebrew Bible actually, you know, doesn't really, there is a Hebrew word mashal, which is likeness, or and it's cognate with the Arabic word in the Quran, which is methel. So, you know, that word is there in Hebrew. But, you know, as far as I know, someone can correct me. I mean, it's in the book, so maybe they will in a book review, inevitably. It's not really central. You know, none of the holy figures of the Hebrew Bible are sort of distinguished by parable telling. You know, you have some anecdotes. So, you know, Nathan famously tells a story to teach a lesson to David about the sheep and all of that. But it's so central to the narratives on Jesus. And it's not just that he told parables. It's that his parable telling in, you know, I think it's particularly the Synoptic Gospels, says something about his nature, that he had been sent by God to sort of divide the believers from the unbelievers, those on the inside, those from the outside. Those on the inside are given the interpretation of parables, those on the outside are not. You know, Jesus will quote in the Gospels some lines from Isaiah, which, you know, speak about this inside-outside division. So it presumably in the lived spirituality of Christians in the 5th, 6th, 7th century in the Middle East, this was just, like Christians today, you know, parable of the Good Samaritan, the prodigal son, it's just kind of a Jesus thing, you know? So I don't think this was invented in, I don't know, Protestant America. I think it was there already. That, you know, Jesus is associated with parables, and his parable telling signals sort of a divine charisma. The Quran picks this up. Allah is, he doesn't only tell parables in the Quran. The Quran explicitly says he tells the best of parables. The Quran says that he's not ashamed to tell parables, even a parable about something as small as a gnat. So it's really concerned to sort of present its God as a parable teller. To me, this is, you know, a super interesting, because it says something about the social cultural context of the Quran's author that has to do with competition with Christianity.
Well, and it's also fascinating in the way that it differs from certainly, you know, modern popular homiletic and, you know, sermonic treatments of the parables, where the parables are treated simply as a rhetorical strategy, something that would have been available to anyone. Jesus happened to use it, and this is the way that Jesus happened to use it, right? And to a large extent, I mean, in modern biblical studies as well, you know, St. Paul's periodic sentence and Jesus' parables are treated as basically analogous. But it seems that the Quran treats it as some kind of divinely bestowed power that not everyone could tap into. I mean, am I getting that basically right, or am I misreading?
I think it's 100% right. It's just, to me, just the simple fact that the Quran has God tell a parable, and then it says, and God tells parables for people, like that it makes that sort of meta sort of commentary. Okay, God has just told a parable, but then it says God tells parables for people. That it adds that commentary, it's, you know, tapping into this association in the cultural context, I think, in which a parable is seen as a sort of divine, a signal of divinity.
And listeners, this is something that I'm definitely going to take away from this book and this conversation, that, again, you know, something that a question I hadn't even thought to pose emerges as precisely in this kind of historical investigation. So, you know, not all rhetorical devices are equal in the, you know, late antique world, the way that they are in, you know, modern and postmodern rhetorical manuals. So that's something to yes. think on. That's something I'm not ready to pronounce on yet, but I certainly need to think about.
So if I could just give a quick example that might help the listeners too, just visualize, because I'm speaking very generally about parables. I've mentioned before the light verse, so if we just stick with that. So the light verse begins, Allahu nur as-samawati wal ard. God is the light of the heavens and the earth. And then it goes on to describe its light, which is compared to a lamp in a niche, so in a sort of little cove or alcove of a wall, which is lit from the blessed oil of an olive tree, which is neither in the east nor the west. Now, there's biblical things going on, like Zechariah and some other language there from the Hebrew Bible. And then it goes on to say, وَيَضْرِبُ اللَّهُ الْأَمْثَالَ لِلنَّاسِ. And God strikes parables, similitudes, for people. So, there's almost this flourish, like you can see the author composing a sort of rhetorical flourish, which will present its God. No, theologically, it's the one God in things, but just if we stick with the text, we'll present its God as having this charisma that an audience in 7th century Arabia would recognize as a divine quality.
I love that. Well, Gabriel, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about the Quran, religious histories, or whatever else as we head for the door?
Yeah, thank you, Nathan, for that. I think maybe the most intriguing thing about the book, and something which needs more in historical investigation, is we see the Quran addressing Christians and sometimes Christianity as a friend, and so even holding up Christians as a model. And then in other places, we see the Quran sort of severely criticizing Christian doctrine and sometimes Christians as well. And so, you know, you have this friends and enemies, you know, my kids would say frenemies, a vibe going on in the Quran's relationship with Christianity. And, you know, the one takeaway is this is a complicated relationship, but above all, Christianity and the Quran and early Islam were in an intimate relationship from the beginning.
Gabriel Sayed Reynolds, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you, Nathan. Happy to be here.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is Christianity and the Quran from Yale University Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack, and I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.